This week, the New York Times reported that all of Washington is consumed with debate over the direction of the war in Iraq. The debate erupted following a statement by Democratic Congressman John Murtha. He said that the war in Iraq was a flawed policy wrapped in illusion and called for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. A spokesman for the Bush administration responded by comparing the retired Marine Colonel Murtha to filmmaker Michael Moore. The next day, House Republicans pushed the issue to a vote, bringing forward a resolution for immediate troop withdrawal. The vote was rejected 403-3. Norman Solomon argues that the war has not gone wrong, it was always wrong. Norman Solomon is founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's a syndicated columnist on media and politics, and his most recent book is War Made Easy. Norman Solomon joins me this morning from California. Hello, Norman.
Good morning.
Now, what exactly was John Murtha saying should happen?
He was calling for, essentially, in political terms, immediate withdrawal, but as a practical matter, he said that 6 months should elapse between now and when all of the U.S. troops are pulled out of Iraq.
And why did it create such a furor?
Well, it's an odd thing about the U.S. media and the Washington press corps. If people were correct all along, at least as I see it, having always opposed this war, if members of Congress, and there were precious few, that opposed the occupation as soon as it began, then they are somewhat discounted as the usual suspects. But John Murtha, a longtime Democratic Party congressperson from Pennsylvania, is anything but a usual suspect. He's a very strong supporter of the military, of the Pentagon, supported the invasion, generally supports militarized policies out of the U.S. government. And so when he declared this policy position, which was quite different than what he had been saying previously, it was seen as a bellwether and was actually quite a shock.
What's behind his opposition?
He talks about the Americans who he has met in hospital, in places like Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, those who have lost limbs, who have suffered grievous wounds from being in Iraq. And he's gone to funerals. He has talked to loved ones of those who have died in Iraq, Americans. And I think it's the combination of that and his belief, as he said, that it's a flawed policy wrapped in illusions. If it were simply one or the other, he would be soldiering on, so to speak. But the combination, I think, has proved to just be too much for him to maintain his support for the war.
Do you think a large part of it is based on the fact that Americans are getting killed?
Undoubtedly. I think it's the combination that Americans are being killed and that there is no really end in sight. And that combined with the fact that, as evidence has emerged, clearly there was major deception out of the White House in promoting the war in the first place.
Well, can you explain to us what happened with the debate, actually? Because I know that the Republicans brought the motion and then the Democrat to withdraw, and then the Democrats voted in against it. What was happening there?
Well, those were machinations, basically. I think the Republican Party, of course, the majority in Congress, aligned with the president, they were originally and initially taken aback by Murtha's statement and the publicity that it got. And in trying to respond, the best they could think of was to get rid of any nuance in his statement and turn it into at least somewhat different resolution or measure that would then be put to an up or down vote. And as a majority, they could define what the measure would say and that a vote would be called. There's no filibuster allowed in the House. And so they were able to put it in a form that was just politically not viable. And I think it didn't really go too far because it turned into a debate on how Murtha had been dealt with about the war in general. And it was almost an anticlimax, the actual vote.
What will happen, do you think, if withdrawal or calls for withdrawal are based on concerns about American dead and wounded?
Well, it's a double-edged sword politically and in terms of media. On the one hand, it cuts fairly deep because in combination with a majority view now that there was deception from the White House, the loss of over 2,000 American lives does make a difference, especially since those lives and those injuries continue. It makes a difference politically. On the other hand, it opens the door to formulas that I think are now being avidly sought by the White House to pull some of the U.S. troops out while killing perhaps even more Iraqis on an ongoing basis. Since the jingoism and the arrogance of the U.S. mass media is sufficient to discount the lives of Iraqis compared to U.S. soldiers, this is an opportunity for the White House now, as it was during the Vietnam War, to say, okay, well, if we must take out some U.S. troops, we will do so, but we will continue to utilize U.S. military technology, air power, bombardment, missiles, to try to triumph, or at least hold the line militarily. That really means continued death and destruction and mayhem and, if you will, terrorism inflicted on people in Iraq. But it plays not so badly in U.S. media, perhaps.
Well, I guess the whole issue of deception is it's the deception of the American people. So then it's still the American people are the focus of that uproar about it.
Well, the narcissism of U.S. Media towards the United States, towards those who are called Americans, is almost boundless. And I do look at the distant mirror of the Vietnam War to see a very strong parallel. And with all the differences between now and then, it is still a distant mirror. Not too much has changed under the sun. When American lives are spared, then the situation is largely seen as improving, no matter how many people in another country continue to die as a result of U.S. policy.
Now, your latest book is titled War Made Easy. Why that title, War Made Easy?
There are several meanings to it, and they include that war is made easy by the U.S. political power structure. Easy in the sense of, for most U.S. citizens, it's not too difficult to simply take it in, to assume that it's done for good causes, and to see being in a country making war on another as something quite easy. Of course, there's a lot of horrible irony there, since it's anything but easy for those in the war, either who are firing the U.S. weapons or on the receiving end. Also, I tried to make it easier for people to understand these dynamics of political power. And how we are manipulated through media. And it is the media messaging that makes war fairly easy for the war makers in Washington, even though they're not that involved in actual war making per se. It is their propaganda function that they try to excel in order to make their task more easy, which is to drag a country into war and to keep it there.
And the table of contents for the book is a list of statements, as you say, used to justify war. And you start chapter one, America is a fair and noble superpower, and then you write through to the last chapter, withdrawal would cripple U.S. credibility. Why are these statements so successful?
You might say they're tried, and if not true, then tried and effective. They've been tested in other wars. They've been worked on through polling, through focus groups, and generally they work, at least for a time. It's no accident that they are recurring from one war to another, and I do in the book talk about not only the Vietnam War, but the dozen or so military conflicts since then that the U.S. has been involved in, and to some significant degree, many of these themes are simply recycled, adapted to the situation, playing on the vanity, the arrogance, the ignorance, and the numbing of the American public, and manipulated as such by the mass media and the White House.
And I want to ask you a little more about that last chapter, seeing as we're on the topic of withdrawal, and its withdrawal would cripple U.S. credibility. What kind of arguments are you making in that chapter?
Well, I counter the claims that withdrawal of U.S. troops from a war based on deception would somehow undermine U.S. credibility. Of course, it depends on what kind of credibility we're talking about. If we're to discuss moral credibility and the kind of stature that the U.S. government has, contrary to myth, it actually harms U.S. credibility to maintain a war effort that is so thoroughly discredited in any kind of ethical or moral terms. And this has been a very, again, manipulative line that has been used for decades, most effectively with a long war that has no easy resolution in Vietnam, in Iraq. We can't pull out, as President Lyndon Johnson said, we can't cut and run. As President George W. Bush has said, we can't cut and run.
What do you think the military and the administration have learned so far from the way that things have gone in Iraq?
Well, they've learned that their, especially the White House, belief in rejecting what they have privately disdained as reality-based policies, that it just goes so far, that just because they assumed or wanted to believe that there would be flowers and candy strewn in the path of the occupiers didn't make it so. Just as they believed that, as was famously said by Dick Cheney and others, the American troops would be welcomed as liberators, not occupiers, that they can't just make reality into reality because they want it to be so. And that is, I think, one of the key messages. But, you know, they're given that they believe in might makes right, when you come right down to it, stripped away from rhetoric, the learning is quite tactical. It's not fundamental.
So do you think it will be business as usual if they decide to go to war against Iran?
I think that they'll try to do a better PR job. I think the configuration of a military attack will be different, if only because of limits of people power. The ability to invade is probably quite circumscribed right now, but the ability to utilize cruise missiles and bombers and so forth is unimpeded. And so I don't think that they've learned a lot other than the need to try to redouble their public relations efforts.
What do you think the role of the peace movement should be at this juncture in combating or acting against the occupation in Iraq?
I think the fundamentals have to be continually challenged. The idea that it's the prerogative of the U.S. government to intervene everywhere in the world, the notion that what matters primarily is the loss of U.S. lives rather than the loss of everybody's lives. And I think that the gradualism that is promoted by what has been called the punditocracy, the major media commentators and journalists in Washington and elsewhere in the United States, the gradualism has to be challenged as well, because as an echo of Vietnam, our current circumstance is that the supposed wise men and women say, well, you can't do anything suddenly. That's how wars drag on, and the U.S. has to get out sooner or later. It's up to the peace movement to demand that it be sooner.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me this morning, Norman.
Thank you, Jane.
I've been speaking with Norman Solomon. He's a syndicated columnist on media and politics. His most recent book is War Made Easy. And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.